The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson, and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women, and so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we center and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently.
Well, we are very excited to be here today and to be talking about a very requested subject by our listeners. Today, Michelle and I are going to be talking to you about neurodivergence, aging, and hormones in women and assigned female at birth people.
Yeah, we are so keen to chat about this. And we were talking before we started recording that we'll have to try and actively attempt to limit our rants on sexism in medical research. So look, no promises, but we'll see how we go.
We'll try our best.
Yeah.
So, yeah, part of the reason why Michelle and I really wanted to cover this topic on the podcast is that, you know, the impact that hormones and the transitions that we go through as women actually have a massive impact on us. Our hormones actually impact things from our mood to our levels of motivation, our cognition, how we experience pain or hunger, energy and fatigue. And when we're going through what, you know, some people call our second puberty, which is perimenopause and menopause, a lot of things change and people experience lots of different symptoms that can really impact them and they don't know why, because unfortunately we're not educated as women on the impact that hormones have on us and how to navigate these transitions in a way that tries to preserve our quality of life and moving through them with good physical and mental health the best that we can. And, you know, this is actually echoed in some of the research. So there was a study, an online survey of perimenopausal women to look at how much they knew about perimenopause. And in the study, they found that more than 90% of the women had never been taught about perimenopause, and more than 60% did not feel informed at all about menopause and the impact that it would have on them. And what the study actually suggested was that teaching people from school, you know, school age, so when we're looking at our HPE, health and physical education classes, and sex education, we really need to be talking about aging and what that means for women.
Yeah, so well put. And we actually just don't know enough about it to be able to take ownership of some of what's happening to us and kind of go into what could be called this third act of our life with intention, right? With understanding, with power, with ownership. The reasons for a lot of this kind of lack of knowledge comes down to ageism, comes down to sexism, patriarchy, the pervasive impact of religion, and then also bias in medical research, which Monique and I have talked a lot about, you know, previously. But it wasn't actually until the 1990s in a lot of countries where inclusion of women in medical research was mandated. And so because our experiences were seen as less important, because we weren't in positions of power choosing what to research, a lot of this really, really important information, both from a scientific community perspective, we don't know a lot about, and definitely from an individual perspective, we don't know a lot about.
Yeah, it's definitely frustrating because I think that all of these cultural and societal factors have led to a real stigma about perimenopause and menopause. And in the past, and even now, there are a lot of people that are suffering in silence and feeling like, you know, they're too ashamed to bring it up to their friends or, you know, the older women in their life or family members, or go to the GP and talk about some of the things that they're experiencing. So I really want us to be able to, you know, help break down some of the stigma about it by sharing information through this episode with people, and hopefully starting conversations about it. Because, you know, researching for this episode, I was surprised by a lot of the studies and the things that I learned. And I'm someone who likes to be prepared. Like, I want to know what's happening 5 or 10 years before it actually happens to me. So I can make some plans and try and, you know, achieve the best outcome I can. And I really feel like if we all knew this in our 20s and 30s, we would actually go about thinking about our 40s and 50s, you know, which are the peak years of going through this hormonal transition, and plan ahead for them. There are some women that experience perimenopause and menopause in a way that is quite severe and impacts their ability to work and impacts their relationships. And so, you know, if we can kind of prepare for that, I think that's only a good thing. One of the things that is showing that this is really important is that the World Health Organization actually lists menopause as an important consideration, that it considers that the social, psychological, and physical health impacts and supports during the menopausal transition should be an integral part of healthcare. And the World Health Organization is committed to increasing the understanding of menopause by raising awareness of it and wanting it to be included in terms of training of health professionals and being covered as part of universal healthcare as well.
Yeah. And I mean, like, that's obviously a good thing, but to me, it is insane that we need to, in quotes, raise awareness of something that happens to over 50% of the population, that we even need to have a conversation about normalizing menopausal symptoms, perimenopausal symptoms. It happens to actually the majority of people, slight majority, but still over 50% of the population are women. And so, you know, I really feel like this goes back to a lot of the deep internalized stigma and shame that women feel about normal things going on for us, a normal part of existing in a female body. So, you know, again, I think we're huge proponents of just calling things what they are. Yeah. If you're like, actually, I'm really sweaty right now because I'm going through perimenopause. Great. You're allowed to say that. That's not something that you should feel ashamed by or feel any sense of like, oh, I need to hide this. In a similar sense of, you know, we think about periods and going through puberty and things like that. For me, as a younger person, I used to always like almost like hide my tampon in, like, if I was going to the bathroom. It's like, why? And when you think about the impact of that on us as young girls, it actually makes so much sense about how then that flows on to, as you were saying, Monique, the second puberty almost of menopause. We've learned from a really young age that things that our bodies do and things that we experience as uniquely female experiences are shameful and should be hidden. And we should come up with an excuse or a reason that's not to do with our bodies. Oh my God, God forbid, right? So at the end of this episode, we would love for all our listeners, whatever gender, whatever sex, to come away from this understanding that menopause is a normal part of the human experience and increasing knowledge and awareness of what menopause is.
Yeah. And, you know, menopause is a biological hormonal transition, but it's also a social transition as well. Like, often people are transitioning roles. We've talked about in our previous episode on hormones. We might have talked about the maiden, the mother, and the crone archetypes. So basically, when you're a young woman, you're going out into the world, you are conquering, you are going on a journey. That's one particular archetype. Then when you're in your 20s or 30s, you know, 40s, you're in the mother archetype of nurturing, growing, creating.
And, you know, just to flag there too, that doesn't have to mean that you're a biological mother. It's an archetype. As you were saying, Monique, it's really about generating, creating.
Yeah, absolutely. You may give birth to your PhD. You.
Love it. Love it.
It's a very long and painful labor.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Less mastitis though.
Yeah. Or, you know, you may give birth to a company or a piece of art that you're creating. You know, there's lots of different ways that you can embody that mother archetype.
Yeah, it's really about being in your creative essence, whatever that means for you.
Yeah. And then, you know, the last archetype is transitioning from the mother, where you're kind of in that really full, ripe stage, bursting with energy, wanting to do lots of things, to transitioning to becoming a crone. Michelle, do you want to take us through that?
Monique's just looking at my face as I can't wait for my crone stage. Yeah. Honestly, I'm just going to like live in a little hut in the woods and rescue animals and make potions. It's going to be a vibe. But yes, more realistically, the crone stage or the crone archetype is really about coming into our wisdom years. And I think this is part of both for men and women, but obviously women experience this disproportionately. The ageism in our society, right? Where it's like once you surpass a certain age, you no longer have usefulness. And this is part of, you know, living in a capitalist society where our value as a human being is seen as our productive years, right? What can we produce? Which is really, you know, in this format that we're going through, it's that kind of mother years, right? What are we creating or producing? Whereas when we come into these wisdom years, these crone years, it's about passing on knowledge, sharing wisdom. It's about actually spending introspective time with ourselves, reflecting, being at peace, finding peace. It might be nurturing or supporting, but in a different way compared to our mother years, nurturing and supporting our community. But it's really about, yeah, I really see it as those wisdom years. And I think part of knowing about menopause, both from, as you were saying, Monique, from a biologic perspective, but also from a social perspective, is actually going through this transition with peace of mind and actually kind of with some excitement. We're like, oh my God, okay, now I'm transitioning into this act 3. I'm in my wisdom years. What do I want this section of my life to look like, rather than going through it with a sense of fear and trepidation?
Yeah, I mean, like I've got quite a few friends who are in their 50s and are navigating this phase of life. And a lot of them have actually said to me that they really feel, out of all the times in their life, that they are the most accepting of themselves, and they don't give any F's, basically. No F's given. They're just unapologetically themselves. Yeah, like it's almost like a bit of a freeing time for people. And sometimes that can come with children growing older and leaving home, kind of like a time where you're a bit more free to pursue your own interests.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess just one last thing that I think is important to flag here is I think, you know, particularly for our autistic listeners, obviously change and particularly body change can be a time of great difficulty, you know, and we know a lot of autistic girls can really struggle with the puberty transition because there's so many things that are out of your control, right, that are going on inside your body. But I think what can be really helpful is even though we can't control exactly what's going on inside your body, what we can do is find predictability within these cycles, knowing what to expect, knowing, you know, what will come and when, not trying to prevent or thwart them, but actually trying to identify, okay, what can I see as my patterns here? What's going on for me? How much can I know about this to kind of make this a bit more predictable for me? And then that can make that a little bit easier, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree. You know, I think being able to identify what's going on for you means that you can also advocate for yourself. to get your healthcare needs met, to get your mental health care needs met, and seek out supports for yourself as you navigate that journey. And, you know, learning about these things, in some ways, it kind of makes it a little bit more predictable because, like what Michelle said, you kind of have a rough idea of what to expect and what to look out for.
So in this next section, what we'd love to do is just take you guys through what actually is menopause, like what's actually going on in our bodies through the menopause transition from a hormonal point of view and from a brain-based point of view. So one thing, just to caveat quickly here, is we're talking a lot today about what's called sex hormones. So hormones that are involved in our sexual reproduction, in our secondary sex characteristics, things like that. But hormones actually are not just sex hormones. There's lots of different hormones in our body that do all sorts of different things. So keeping in mind that when we do talk about hormones today, we are talking about sex hormones, but there's also lots of different types of hormones as well. And essentially hormones are just types of neurotransmitters. So to get into some of our sex hormones involved in the menopause transition, firstly, and most importantly, we want to talk about estrogen. So for most people, we generally think of estrogen as one thing, but actually, there's three different forms of estrogen that our body produces. And these three forms are really actually important to understand when we think about, you know, what changes in our estrogen production through the menopause transition. So each of these forms of estrogen have their own very specific scientific name. Monique and I had a go at pronouncing them before, and we've decided that we're just not going to pronounce them. And we're going to call them by their acronym, which is E1, E2, and E3. E1 is the first form of estrogen that we experience as humans. So this is the main source of estrogen that we have before puberty. So men and male individuals have E1 as well. And so we also have E1 as our main source of estrogen after menopause. And this is what we can think of as essentially like our least potent form of estrogen. So our ovaries produce a little bit of E1, but it mainly comes from fatty tissues and through processes in our adrenal glands. So this is important to know because, firstly, too much stress can reduce the production of E1. And this is because our adrenal glands are essentially too busy making cortisol, our stress hormone. And also it's important to know because a lot of women, because of our obsession with thinness and youth, a lot of women experience a lot of anxiety about putting on weight, you know, over the menopause transition, but it's actually incredibly healthy for you to put on a bit of weight when you're going through menopause because our fatty tissue is another key source of E1. So something really important to keep in mind.
Yeah. And I think actually understanding that biological information can help people have compassion towards themselves and their body when they're going through this process. Like, I personally found it very reassuring to know that, you know, actually your body is just doing its best to try and help you and give you a bit more estrogen, you know, to kind of like supplement you as your other levels of estrogen are declining. And I was like, wow, the body is so smart. I never knew that that's what it was doing.
So this then brings us to our second form of estrogen, and which we're calling E2. And this is the estrogen that is our primary source of estrogen during our fertile years. So this is what we typically think of as estrogen. This form of estrogen triggers the onset of our secondary sex characteristics. So boobs, hips, things like that. And it's very active in a lot of psychological and physical functions during our fertile years. And when we talk a little bit more later today about symptoms of menopause, cognitive changes, things like that, we'll be chatting a lot about how this E2, this, you know, primary form of estrogen, plays a role in a lot of those things. So then the final form of estrogen that our bodies produce, E3, this is predominantly produced just during pregnancy. So following from about 8 weeks onwards of pregnancy. It also exists in really low levels in non-pregnant people, but it's mainly a pregnancy-based, you know, form of estrogen.
So estrogen has a significant effect on lots of different parts of the body. So things like the brain, the heart, your hair, your skin, your bones and muscles. And estrogen has an anti-inflammatory property in it and a neuroprotective property for the brain as well. well. There are estrogen receptors all over the body, not just, you know, around your reproductive organs. And estrogen actually plays a role in the central nervous system. So it has an effect on the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or the HPA axis, which controls your stress response.
So then we've got our pituitary glands, which also produce two types of hormones, which are involved in really like our ovulatory cycles and our menstrual cycles. So we've got follicle stimulating hormones, or FSH, and we've got luteinizing hormone. So these two hormones are just involved in, firstly, producing follicles in our ovaries, so producing an egg. And then we've got luteinizing hormone, which triggers the actual release of the egg. And then testosterone. So this is like traditionally the male sex hormone, involved in our libido, energy function, and also in mood. And then our next major sex hormone that is important when we're thinking about the menopause transition is progesterone.
Progesterone is made by the ovaries directly after ovulation when an egg is released. You can have anovulatory cycles where when you're getting into perimenopause, you stop releasing eggs. So you can still have a period, but your body's not actually producing progesterone. It's also produced by the placenta during pregnancy, and it's the hormone that's needed to line the uterus, support pregnancy, and it suppresses the production of estrogen following ovulation. And progesterone actually is helpful in helping to cope with stress, reduce anxiety, and promote sleep, kind of like helps to down-regulate the nervous system. But if you actually don't have the correct amount, like say if you're on a birth control pill that's, you know, has a certain form of progesterone in it and you're on progesterone only, it can lead to things like feeling, you know, depressed mood, basically, because it kind of like downs you too much, if that makes sense.
While we're going through each of the individual functions of all of these things, they all interplay and all interact with each other in complex ways. So, you know, when we think about a hormonal imbalance, the key word there is imbalance, because it's really about the interactive effects between, you know, different sex hormones, other things that are going on. And this is why it's so important that if you're experiencing hormonal issues, to actually get individualized care, because what's going on for you might be different for what's going on for someone else who also is experiencing a hormonal imbalance.
Definitely.
So now that we've gone through a bunch of the important sex hormones involved in menopause, what we're going to do is just take you through each stage of menopause and talk about exactly what it is that's going on and what's shifting with those hormones with each stage. So just generally, when we're thinking about what is changing through the menopause transition, it's essentially we're moving from our fertile years into non-fertile years. So basically our ovaries stop producing eggs. So let's start off at the early stages in perimenopause. So Monique, can you take us through what's going on hormonally in that perimenopause phase?
Yeah, so a lot of people have heard of the term menopause, but I find that not as many people actually know information about perimenopause and what occurs leading up to full menopause. They kind of think the two things are the same. So perimenopause basically occurs in the years leading up to when you achieve full menopause. It can take from a few months up to 10 years, but the average amount of time that people are going through perimenopause is around 4, 5, 6 years. So during perimenopause, your estrogen levels are fluctuating wildly. So there'll be times when you have really high estrogen and times when it really dips. And then it eventually declines until, you know, what Michelle said, the ovaries stop producing eggs. So you can still have periods while you're going through perimenopause, but there may be some cycles where you're producing an egg and then other cycles where you're having an anovulatory cycle where you're not ovulating because there isn't an egg. And, you know, the hormones that you're going through, even though you're bleeding, are different. So menopause occurs when you haven't had a period for at least 12 months. And like Michelle said, there is a full decline of estrogen and the ovaries completely stop releasing eggs. So people will achieve full menopause, usually around the age of 50 to 53. That's sort of the average. Perimenopause is basically a time when your brain and body are adjusting to the ups and downs of estrogen and overall less estrogen and less progesterone as you're kind of transitioning to achieving full menopause. You know, these wildly fluctuating levels of estrogen are what causes a lot of the discomfort that people experience going through perimenopause. And then, you know, as your body adjusts to this transition, some of those symptoms actually improve when you achieve full menopause. So, you know, we're going to be talking about that a little bit further on in the episode, you know, what are the signs and symptoms, but I think it's good to know that a lot of them calm down when you get through, I guess they call it the stormy waters of perimenopause, until you achieve the calm sea of full menopause.
Yeah, absolutely. Bring on the cronies. But yeah, no, exactly right. Exactly right. It's kind of widely understood from a biologic perspective that the driver of a lot of the distress and discomfort and the difficulty that people talk about going through menopause is all to do with these wild fluctuations in different hormone levels. So what a lot of research into this has found is that obviously while we have, you know, fluctuating levels of estrogen and progesterone in our fertile cycles, the intensity and the speed at which these different hormones are fluctuating when we're going through perimenopause is just much more intense, right? Much more rapid. And this can make things really unpredictable. Right. And as you know, you were saying, Monique, you could still have a period, but maybe you didn't ovulate, or maybe you don't have your period, but you actually did ovulate.
And you can actually still get pregnant while in perimenopause. So I think that's really important to know as well. Until you achieve full menopause, you need to do what you need to do, whether it's wanting to have children or needing to be, I guess, cognizant of that and taking birth control or condoms or whatever you need to use if you don't want a pregnancy in perimenopause.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because it happens a lot actually, because, you know, obviously going through perimenopause, you think, great, my doors are closed, the shop has shut up, but it's really common actually for eggs still to be released, but because it's so unpredictable, unlike a normal menstrual cycle when you can kind of predict when your ovulation is going to be, yeah, there's actually a really high rate of unintended pregnancies, you know, in women going through perimenopause. And I think another really important thing to say here too is that accurately identifying perimenopause from a medical point of view, like from a blood test or things like that, is incredibly difficult and inaccurate. And that's because you could get a blood test one day, but then the next day, the ratios of the different sex hormones going on is totally different because of these wild fluctuations. So it's really important that if you feel like you're going through perimenopause and you're identifying with a lot of the symptoms, if you go in and say, oh, like to your doctor and say, I'd like to get that confirmed. Can I have a blood test? And the blood test comes back and your doctor says, no, no way. You absolutely can't be in perimenopause because of, you know, the different ratios of your different sex hormones at this point. That doesn't mean that you're not in perimenopause. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
Yeah. And honestly, I find that kind of frustrating that there isn't, you know, an accurate test where you can kind of know for sure. Usually if you are over 45 and you're reporting, you know, all the symptoms of perimenopause, your doctor will then kind of go through an assessment process based on what's occurring for you. Whereas if you're under the age of 45 and possibly going through early or premature perimenopause or menopause, that's where they might do some other health tests to kind of screen for, is it an illness causing this or a thyroid problem? Why is this occurring early? But what can happen for some people is they get early menopause, and it's considered early when it occurs between 40 and 45 years old, and premature perimenopause and menopause before the age of 40. There are people who will go through complete menopause early because they've gone through cancer treatments like chemotherapy, or they've had a full hysterectomy where the uterus and the ovaries have been taken out. But then there are other people who haven't had those, you know, medical treatments.
So when we think about the prevalence of early menopause and premature menopause, so early menopause, that's 8 to 10% of women, and premature menopause, so that's starting perimenopause before 40, that's 1%. And actually what's interesting is there's another, label here, which is late menopause, and that's women who start menopause close to 60. And I actually don't have a prevalence rate on that.
Wow, I didn't even know that you could have menopause that late.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's incredibly rare, right? But, you know, again, it really just speaks to the huge amount of variability in our experiences and why, you know, there needs to be more research around it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much individual difference. For the 1% of women who do start perimenopause before the age of 40, one of the causes of that can be POI, or primary ovarian insufficiency. So that's where your ovaries stop producing eggs and you stop having a period much earlier than expected. So for a lot of cases of POI, they don't actually know what has caused that for the person, but there are some risk factors that can kind of predict whether someone has a higher chance of having primary ovarian insufficiency. So some of the risk factors are: if your period started before age 11, if you have a family history, so a genetic history of family members having premature or early menopause, smoking, having epilepsy, having previous surgery on your ovaries, certain genetic conditions, and metabolic disorders or infections. And this actually surprised me, but having autoimmune diseases such as Addison's disease, which affects cortisol, thyroid disease, type 1 diabetes, Crohn's disease, and celiac disease as well. So yeah, again, I'd love for more people to know these things so that they can kind of chat through with their medical professional. If you have some of these things going on and you're wanting to maybe start a family, like knowing about this and being able to work through with your medical professional what that means for you.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think, again, we are a bit of a broken record with this, but knowledge is absolutely power. So it is really important, though, to be aware that early and premature menopause and perimenopause can happen, and to know what the signs are. So we're going to go through in the next section, what are some of the symptoms and signs of perimenopause. And the reason for this is because for individuals who have early and particularly premature menopause, they're often treated with hormone therapy until the average age of natural menopause, which is around 50. And this is really important because that's to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, and also to support brain health. So we'll talk a little bit more about the role of E2, our, you know, primary source of estrogen in brain functioning in a moment. But, you know, that E2, so that primary fertile estrogen, is involved in so many functions in our body. And so one of the risks of having particularly early or premature menopause is that actually it puts women at higher risk of cardiovascular disease. So it's really important, again, to be aware of what are the signs and what can I do to actually keep myself healthy going forward.
Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word.
Brains can get very noisy. I tend to go through phases in what's most helpful in quieting that noise and recentering. And at the moment, I've been gravitating towards music and soundscapes, slowly making my way through the huge library on the Calm app. And I've been trying to get better at having a more peaceful morning routine. And I've definitely found that the morning playlists really help a lot with that, actually.
Yeah, I think most people think of meditation as the only way we can ground ourselves and quiet our brain, but sound and music are actually so helpful. What's really cool about the music and sound library on Calm is the variety. They've got playlists for times of the day and certain moods, soundscapes, and even alpha wave and bilateral stimulation tracks, which can be incredibly effective at helping you to emotionally regulate and getting your brain in a sleep-ready state.
For sure. My favorites at the moment are the Disney soundscapes. So they've got things like An Evening in Jasmine's Garden, Merida's Mystical Scottish Forest, as well as other ones that you'd expect, like Rolling Thunderstorms and the like.
The Calm app puts the tools that you need to feel better in your back pocket. If you go to calm.com/neuro, you'll get a special offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription. And new content is added every week.
For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/neuro.
Go to calm.com/neuro for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/neuro. Okay, so Michelle and I are going to go through a list of common signs of perimenopause and menopause. And just note that, you know, some of these things are not going to apply to everybody, but we're giving a really comprehensive list because people may have experienced some of these without maybe realizing that they were related to perimenopause and full menopause. So we're just giving you the information for psychoeducation purposes and then, you know, see your medical professionals if needed. So one of the signs of perimenopause is experiencing dry and itchy skin. So I had no idea that this was a symptom, but a lot of women are saying that they're so uncomfortable because they're itchy all the time and it's really annoying. And, you know, your skin dries out because estrogen actually plays a role in collagen production. People can get increased acne as well because when they're going through perimenopause, there's fluctuations in, you know, testosterone and androgens. As the estrogen decreases and progesterone decreases, it kind of puts things a little bit more out of balance. People experience aching muscles and joints. And again, I had no idea that this was actually a symptom of perimenopause. And so there are a lot of women in midlife suddenly feeling like, you know, oh my God, have I got fibromyalgia? You know, what's going on? And it's actually because you're losing some of the protective effects that estrogen has because estrogen is anti-inflammatory. People experience heart palpitations.
Yeah. And I think this is something that, again, is not often commonly identified as, you know, a potential menopausal or perimenopausal symptom because we know, again, estrogen plays a hugely protective role in our cardiovascular system. And so this is one of the reasons why, as we were chatting about before, women who are experiencing early or premature menopause are recommended to go on hormone replacement therapy because of the increased risk of heart attack and increased risk of cardiovascular issues. So definitely, if you are experiencing heart palpitations or cardiovascular issues, please go straight to your doctor because, you know, yes, it's part of or can be part of, you know, the menopausal transition, but absolutely you want to make sure that that is, you know, looked at and taken care of rather than just doing what a lot of women do, which is, I'll be fine.
Yeah, or having it dismissed as anxiety and a panic attack as well.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
One of the other signs of perimenopause is hair loss. So losing some of the hair on your head, but gaining some hair on your face as well. So
what a win. I know. Love that.
And like when I was younger, I used to kind of see my mom trying to like, sorry, mom, for like telling this about you, but like trying to pluck the hair from her chin. And I was like, that's never going to happen to me. Like, ew. And guess what? It's happening. It's like, damn it.
Yes. So sad. Well.
Another one that I had no idea about, but basically you're kind of losing some of the, like, the fluid and the lubricant in your body, which we'll talk a little bit more about in other areas soon, but it can lead to dry eyes, which I had no idea about, and also, like, losing some of your saliva production, which can give people dry mouth or an experience of something called burning mouth, that's due to kind of the loss of lubrication in your mouth. And that can actually increase dental issues and gum issues, which, again, I had no idea about. But I really feel like, you know, we need to know this information to make sure we're going to the dentist or, you know, getting this stuff checked out. What can also happen as well, particularly once you're kind of getting probably more towards achieving full menopause, where your estrogen is really dropping, is you can get what's called genitourinary syndrome of menopause, which basically is where you get vaginal dryness and atrophy. So, you know, the area around there really changes. You lose some of the fat and the padding. You lose some of the lubrication. And what can end up happening is it can be really painful for people to wipe themselves after going to the toilet or having sex. And, you know, this is one of the things that can also be treated with hormone replacement therapy. So people don't have to suffer, you know, from this. And what that can also impact as well is more frequency of getting UTIs because of the loss of lubrication and changes in that area and having increased urinary frequency as well. One of the other changes is, and I didn't know this, but due to changes with things like, you know, the progesterone, people can get worse headaches and migraines when they're going through perimenopause.
Yeah, I think that's a really important and great point because, again, when we think about migraines, actually women are more likely to experience migraines than men over a lifetime. So the prevalence of migraines for women is about 43% compared to 18%. For men, and menstrual migraines actually affect about 50% of women.
What?
Crazy, right?
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. And no one talks about it. And I think it's a very gendered, like our reaction to migraines can be very sexist and gendered because, again, it's not something that's visible from the outside. It's something that the person is experiencing. And because it is often experienced by women, much more so than men, it's often played up as just neuroses or, oh, she's got a headache, you know, she's playing it up. Whereas anyone who's experienced a migraine knows that it is not a headache, right? It's a syndrome. Migraines is actually a full body syndrome. And so I think it's a great point, Monique, that you flag migraines as a potential symptom of perimenopause because we know, you know, the reason that women can get menstrual migraines is because of the interaction between estrogen and progesterone. And it tends to happen more so in women who are particularly sensitive to changes in their internal, you know, hormone balance. Women who've experienced menstrual migraines, you know, throughout their fertile years can sometimes actually in perimenopause stop experiencing those migraines or they can continue. But also women who've never experienced a migraine before in their life and never experienced menstrual migraines can suddenly start to have onset of migraines during perimenopause.
Wow. Yeah, so important to know. And, you know, we know through the research actually that both autistic and ADHD people are more likely to experience migraine symptoms. So if you're a woman or assigned female at birth and, you know, you're neurodivergent and going through perimenopause and menopause, it's a bit of a situation.
Yum. Yeah, it's a perfect storm.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to changes in periods, we've talked a little bit about, you know, eggs releasing and the impact of that, but with perimenopause and heading towards full menopause, there can be changes in your uterus and the lining of your uterus. So when you have less progesterone, basically progesterone helps regulate the growth of the endometrium, which is the uterine lining. So it can become thicker before it's shed, resulting in really heavy periods. So I've known quite a few women who have experienced really heavy ongoing bleeding in perimenopause, sometimes for months, leaving them feeling really unwell and needing things like iron transfusions. And what can end up happening in perimenopause as well because of this hormone shift is you can sometimes develop fibroids, which are basically benign growths on the wall of the uterus, and polyps as well. So, you know, there are different medical things you can do to treat those, usually under a gynecologist. But I think it's just good to kind of flag if you're having abnormal bleeding and you're possibly in perimenopause, please go to your GP and get this checked out. A couple of the other symptoms that Michelle's going to go through a bit later are experiencing brain fog. So feeling like your memory and concentration isn't as good. Also experiencing hot flashes and night sweats. So basically they think that that happens because the change in estrogen affects a part of your brain called the hypothalamus. And that changes your body's sensitivity to heat. And your body then tries to cool you down by making you sweat. And they reckon that about 75% of people going through perimenopause experience hot flashes and night sweats. And about 25% of these people experience them severely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hot flashes is something that in pop culture, like, that's often what we think about, right? When we think about menopause, oh, you know, she's having a hot flash. But it is actually such a debilitating, or can be such a debilitating symptom, because exactly as you're saying, Monique, because of changes in estrogen, which then affects our hypothalamus, what essentially happens is our window of tolerance for temperature differences shrink. And so our body then, we slightly rise in temperature, our body is like, oh crap, you know, we're overheated. And, you know, as is typical, we'll all try and cool us down by making us sweat. And we'll also actually make our skin really hot by opening up the blood vessels close to our skin, which is a long-term strategy for cooling us down, but makes you feel flushed in the moment. And because of the suddenness, it comes on you really quickly. But the other aspect of a hot flash that often, you know, we don't think about is the stress component of it. So because it's such a sudden, our body is perceiving it as such a sudden onset of threat, right? Oh my God, we're suddenly overheated. It actually launches a cortisol response as well, and an adrenaline response. So a lot of women, when they get a hot flash, yes, there's the heat and the sweating and, you know, the physical component of it, but often also report feelings of anxiety or dread or stress, which comes with it as well.
One of the other things with perimenopause is experiencing sleep difficulties and insomnia. And that can sometimes be because progesterone, which has a calming effect, is fluctuating. But also it's usually partly because of experiencing night sweats and hot flashes, and that disturbing people's sleep as well.
Yeah, the sleep one is a really interesting one. And exactly as you say, you know, progesterone can be a factor in that we're more agitated potentially. The night sweats, the hot flashes obviously can disturb our sleep as well. And the other factor in that as well is actually the interrelationship between melatonin, serotonin, and estrogen. What's super interesting is that our sleep-wake cycles are governed by, you know, our body clock, which is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And it governs our melatonin release, which governs our sleep-wake cycles, but it actually also is involved in our menstrual cycles as well. So essentially what that means is that melatonin, estrogen, and serotonin are all kind of linked together. So our melatonin actually helps to regulate our estrogen, you know, in the same way as it regulates our sleep-wake cycle. Serotonin regulates our mood, but then declining serotonin leads to reduced melatonin, which then leads to reduced sleep, right? And differences in our estrogen regulation. And then finally, to complete the circle, estrogen is needed to produce serotonin. So if we think about that interrelationship, if we are experiencing a drop in estrogen, then what's going to happen is we're going to get a drop in serotonin as well. That's going to mean that we're producing less melatonin, which is then going to interrupt our sleep, which is also going to impact the release of our estrogen. So all of that as well, I will just say, you know, sounds very serious and like, oh my God, you know, my body's falling apart. What the hell's going on? But it is really, really important to note that a lot of these changes, as we've flagged before, are specific to perimenopause, right? Before we've achieved full menopause. So these things aren't a forever thing. It's really while our body gets used to switching from E2, like our primary source of estrogen, to E1. Right? Different source of estrogen. And it gets used to just a different ratio and balance of hormones in general. So it's not like this is forever. It's just these are the things that occur during the shift.
Yeah, wow. It's complicated. You know, I'm constantly in awe of the body and how complex so many processes are that we don't know about, you know, when you're just living your day-to-day life. Coming towards the end of the list, one of the things that people report experiencing is fatigue during this transition. And part of that might be, you know, the impact on sleep, but also I just hear from a lot of people going through this transition that they need to rest more. Unfortunately, it can coincide with a really busy time in people's life, especially in their 40s, where they're still raising children and working. And, you know, I really think that, again, we talked about this on some of our other episodes, but I really think society is not set up to accommodate the different hormonal stages that women progress through, because it's been based really around the male hormonal cycle, which is just steady and consistent, you know, for the whole of the person's working life.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And as we've talked about before, you know, around like burnout and just, you know, lots of different episodes that we've done, allowing yourself, if possible, and of course it's complicated, as you said, you know, given the stage of life that this often happens in, but allowing yourself time to rest and to meet your body's needs in the same way as when we go through puberty, our bodies are exhausted because they're completely shifting frameworks, essentially, for how they function. It's the same thing when we go through perimenopause, and the same grace that we allow teenagers. I think it would be really lovely if we could offer that grace to ourselves during these periods as well.
Okay, so the last thing that we're going to talk about in terms of the experiences that people have when going through perimenopause is a change in their mood and, you know, emotional regulation. So a lot of people will report an increase in anxiety at this time in their life, an increase in low mood and depression. And then also what is often talked about is an increase in anger and rage. And I've had, again, female friends in their 40s and 50s tell me that by the time you get to that age, you're just sick of people's crap and you just cannot, your tolerance drops and you just cannot put up with it any longer. And, you know, this is actually a time period where I've seen relationship breakdowns, women get divorced and things like that, because maybe things that they were tolerating prior to this time in their life, when they have this shift, you know, in their hormones and their mood, they can no longer tolerate certain things. But it's not sort of widely spoken about outside of these female friendships.
Yeah, such an important thing to flag. And I guess it really highlights the impact of multiple different factors, right? So firstly, we've got situational and just aging factors. You know, I think a lot of women, as you go through life, you know, we often start off life really heavily brainwashed that our purpose is to make everyone else happy and we always have to be accommodating and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then the older you get, the more you realize, hang on, no, I don't. And, you know, that kind of falls away and we're able to become more ourselves and more ourselves in relationship as well. Because oftentimes, you know, we think, oh, the best way to promote the health of this relationship is I will just personally have no needs and I will just always accommodate the other person in the relationship's needs. But actually the way to have really healthy, meaningful relationships is to show up and be authentically ourselves. And that means expressing what our needs are. And I think as women, we often get better and better at that as we get older. And then also we've got the added layer of all of of the hormone shifts going on through the perimenopause phase. Firstly, we've got progesterone is decreasing. Well, as we've chatted about, progesterone helps us to feel calm. It's an anti-anxiety hormone, essentially. And then we've also got changes in serotonin production during this time as well, which is another mood stabilizer. So essentially, like two of our primary, what we might think of as mood stabilizer hormones, are declining or in flux is probably a better way to describe that. And so that often makes us much more sensitive and reactive and responsive to external things going on. Whereas previously, we might have been like, yep, that really annoys me or upsets me, but it's not worth the trouble. Whereas when we take away those mood stabilizer hormones, suddenly it is worth the trouble.
Yeah, definitely agree with all of that, Michelle. And I think, you know, another factor that can come into this discussion around mood changes and the impact of hormones is, say, for example, if you have a history of already experiencing mental health issues like depression or anxiety or PTSD and trauma, then possibly, you know, going through this perimenopausal transition, I'm just wondering if it could impact people even more, and people might need to actually increase their supports, the services that they're engaging with.
Yeah, absolutely. Pre-existing stuff is really important to take into account because essentially it's just a vulnerable time. There's such a huge amount of shifts and changes going on within you that you're more vulnerable to a lot of different things, mental health stuff, physical health stuff, cognitive stuff, which we'll talk about in the next section. But, you know, I think something that is helpful to keep in mind there, and not to scare anyone, but actually, one of the peak ages for onset of psychosis for women is after 45. So in the perimenopause phase. So peak age of onset for men is in their late teens. And for women, we've got, as I said, after 45 and also in the mid to late 20s. So, you know, we know that one of the key factors in that is changes in progesterone and estrogen. So again, not saying this to be, you know, a waver of a terrifying flag, but just as a way of understanding, you know, it is such a vulnerable time. And it's really important to be aware of that and to be clued into the symptoms that you're having, to advocate for yourself, to put the supports in place that you need so that actually you can navigate this period with the most functioning that you can.
Yeah. And I think this is where mental health providers and not just physical health providers need to be aware of the impact, you know, of perimenopause and that this is a vulnerable time. And, you know, as psychologists and psychiatrists, like we all need to have training in this and be up to date with this because, again, you know, like you've said, 50%, like just over 50% of the world's population is going to go through this transition. So it is relevant.
So another really commonly reported symptom in perimenopause is brain fog, right? And cognitive symptoms more widely. So brain fog is not a diagnostic term, but it's a really nice descriptive term. So it's essentially this feeling of general haziness, having difficulty finding words is a big one, difficulty remembering things. So short-term memory, working memory. And so these cognitive symptoms can actually be incredibly distressing for a lot of women going through menopause and perimenopause. And the reason for that is, again, because there isn't a great understanding of what to expect and what's normal versus not normal for that stage of life and you know, going through that transition. So a lot of women in this phase will often actually worry that they're experiencing early onset dementia or that there's something quite serious, you know, that's going on, something neurocognitive that's actually degenerating or declining for them. So I want to just go through some of the key cognitive symptoms or cognitive experiences that are really common for perimenopause, because it is quite different to what we would expect for, say, an early onset dementia, and also just for normal aging. So one of the main areas that women experience difficulty with cognitively with perimenopause is learning and memory. So the mechanism for this in perimenopause is, of course, to do with estrogen. So we know that estrogen, and this is the E2, so, you know, our primary fertile years estrogen, is really heavily involved in the production of two really important neurotransmitters. So these are called acetylcholine and glutamate. So the job of these two neurotransmitters is to encode and develop new memories. The issue when we've got a decline in estrogen is that less estrogen means less production of these two really important neurotransmitters, which essentially just means that there's not enough ingredients at a neurobiological level to make new memories. So the problem isn't in forgetting. It's not like you encoded something, remembered it, knew it. The problem is in the front end with encoding it in the first place. So you're going to have more difficulty when you're going through perimenopause with encoding new information. And what's really interesting is this is a bit of a similar picture to ADHD, but there's a different mechanism. So again, lots of ADHDers will say, oh, I'm really forgetful and I have a terrible memory. It's actually not really to do with memory for ADHDers, it's to do with difficulty encoding information. And that's to do with working memory challenges and kind of front-end information processing stuff. So check out our episode on executive functioning if you want to learn more about that. But so when we're focusing on menopause and, you know, our hormones and how that's involved in memory, it's really interesting actually, because during different stages of our menstrual cycle, when we have high estrogen, what they've actually found is that the connectivity in the different regions of our brain that are involved in memory formation, so this is our hippocampi, the connectivity in these regions can be increased by up to 25% compared to other stages in our cycle. So that's pretty amazing, right? Our cognitive function massively, or in terms of our memory, right, massively improves during particularly high estrogen stages of our cycle. And so when it comes to, you know, these cognitive changes during perimenopause, again, it's not a forever thing. It's specific to this stage or this phase of your life, right? This transition, because essentially what's happening is our brain is getting used to switching over from E2, so, you know, the fertile years estrogen as its primary source of estrogen, to E1 as its primary source of estrogen. So during that transition phase, things can be a little tricky. Some other areas of cognitive challenge that women can experience during perimenopause is reduced impulse control and also difficulty with what's called verbal fluency. So this is our ability to retrieve verbal information from mind. So estrogen is also involved in functional pathways in our brain that help us with verbal fluency. So if you're struggling to find words, that's why. You're not losing your mind. It's just that temporarily you're having more difficulty than usual with your verbal fluency. And the last of the key kind of cognitive symptoms that we see in perimenopause is more difficulty with concentration. So impulse control and concentration are both executive functioning skills. And there's aspects of our executive function system that rely on, or, you know, that estrogen is involved in. And they're the areas that very specifically we experience a decline in or difficulty with during the perimenopause phase. So just to recap, we've got learning and memory, we've got verbal fluency, so retrieving verbal information from mind, impulsivity increases. So we've got less impulse regulation, right? Behavioral regulation. And this is to do with emotion regulation as well. And then more difficulty with concentration.
So is this also maybe part of why, you know, before perimenopause, you would have your inside thoughts, but you wouldn't let them out? And then during perimenopause, you just decide to let them out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, people don't often think about verbal impulsivity as part of impulsivity, but it absolutely is. That's a great example. Saying the thing before we've actually thought about if we want to or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, yeah, I get that. I get it.
I really do.
So as I said before, you know, I think a lot of women going through perimenopause feel really scared and frightened when they're experiencing some of these cognitive changes, because we have such limited knowledge about the fact that that is part of perimenopause. And so often we jump straight to, oh my God, well, it must be dementia. It must be this, it must be that. And that can be really terrifying just because we don't know what else it could possibly be. The course and progression of different forms of dementia. So dementia is just an umbrella term that essentially just means a neurodegenerative process. The course and progression of different forms of dementia is incredibly variable and depends on the specific type of dementia that individual is experiencing. So it's beyond the scope of this episode today to go through kind of, you know, all the signs and symptoms of all the various ways, you know, you could experience neurodegeneration. But I guess what I do want to say is that just in terms of prevalence rates and likelihood, the age at which we would likely be experiencing perimenopause is far too young for the typical age that we would experience a dementing process. Not to say it can't happen. Of course, certain forms of dementia, you know, we might experience earlier and we can also get early onset dementia, but it's rare. It's really, really rare. If you are concerned, talk to your doctor about it and you can go through an assessment process to see if that's the case for you. But I actually just think for a lot of us, just knowing what's the typical cognitive experience in perimenopause can help alleviate a lot of those concerns, because you might think, oh, huh, yep, that's what I'm experiencing. And you might feel like you don't need to go down the dementia path.
Michelle's talked about how the fluctuating estrogen affects some of the neurotransmitters like serotonin, but also, it can impact dopamine levels. And we know that dopamine is involved in ADHD. So Attitude did a survey on their website. So it's not an academic paper or anything like that. It's not peer reviewed. But they did a really interesting survey of women who are ADHDers who are in perimenopause or full menopause. So they surveyed around 1,500 women. And what the majority of the women actually said, so 95% of the women in the study said that their ADHD symptoms actually grew more severe during perimenopause and menopause. And so for more than half of the women in the study, their ADHD symptoms in their 40s and 50s actually had the greatest impact overall across all the different age periods in their life. So what I found really interesting in this survey is they asked the women what were the symptoms of perimenopause that were the most impactful for them. And what they reported was brain fog or memory issues and overwhelm, which 70% of the women said had a life-altering impact for them in their 40s and 50s. So a lot of them reported being able to mask some of their difficulties and putting in a lot of effort to try and have strategies to compensate for their ADHD and, you know, somehow coping. But what they found was when they got into their 40s and 50s, no amount of hard work could cover up what they were experiencing in terms of really struggling with some of these things and feeling increasing anxiety, overwhelm, and emotional dysregulation. And what the women in the study reported was that some of the new and worsened ADHD symptoms, namely emotional dysregulation, started to affect their relationships during perimenopause and menopause.
Yeah. And I mean, that makes so much sense for ADHDers, right? Because all of these things are things that we've talked about as, you know, these are really common normal symptoms of perimenopause, but also for ADHDers, things like encoding new information, keeping information organized in mind, emotional regulation, they're things that the ADHD brain naturally can find a little bit more difficult. So it's almost like for an ADHD brain is more vulnerable to the effects of perimenopause coming in.
Yeah. And then the third most symptoms that people found were exacerbated in perimenopause were time management difficulties, procrastination, and distractibility. That's sort of like for the perimenopause period. And then I thought it was really interesting in this study, they actually looked at like all these different time periods for women. And what they reported was sort of like the major things that they were dealing with in terms of ADHD symptoms at that stage of their life. And at age 60 plus, the main ones that the women were reporting were brain fog and memory issues, procrastination and then overwhelm. So kind of similar, but in a little bit of a different order.
Yeah. And look, you know, again, I think that is a really interesting example of, you know, firstly, the huge variability in our cognition as we age and all the things that can impact what's called our functional cognition, right? Like, how are we experiencing that thing? And we know the older we get, unfortunately, cognitive function does decline slightly in very specific areas, but it does decline slightly. But unfortunately, the areas that do tend to be impacted are also areas that, again, ADHDers can have naturally more difficulty with. So looking mainly at executive function and encoding of information.
Yeah, and I think this kind of shows that, you know, with ADHD, people really do need support across the lifespan and that, you know, we should actually be increasing supports and services for people who are 40 plus.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about like what are all the different things that might impact that person's functioning at different points of their life. And, you know, I know, Monique, you and I have talked a lot before about how when it comes to ADHD symptomatology, oftentimes the thing that's going on for that person at that point in their life is the thing that is either exacerbating or mitigating their underlying experience of ADHD. And so thinking about aging and menopause as really crucial, you know, factors to consider, I think is really important for all healthcare providers and for the individual as well.
So the other thing I really like about this survey is they actually asked people what things did they try to help them with the symptoms that they were experiencing, because there isn't that much research out there at the moment on the unique experiences of ADHDers and perimenopause and menopause. And there's not much that kind of is asking people, what are they doing and what are they finding is working for them? So yeah, something I found interesting was that people reported that getting a diagnosis of their ADHD was really important because it meant that they could then access ADHD medication. The survey showed that 40% of the respondents, they said that the stimulant medication was really helpful in treating their ADHD symptoms while going through perimenopause. What also was helpful was exercise. So exercise was deemed effective or very effective by 37% of the women in the survey. Nutrition was labeled as effective by 27%, and mindfulness was favored by 30%. More than 60% of the women said that they had changed their diet, fitness, and health routine during perimenopause and menopause to better manage their ADHD and the perimenopause symptoms. Some people reported meditation and yoga was helpful, and about 35% of the women in the survey reported that they take hormone replacement therapy or HRT, mostly to address the cognitive and physical symptoms of perimenopause. And of those, 26% said that HRT helped them manage their ADHD symptoms going through this transition. So moving on to the research around autism and menopause. When I was having a look at this, because I've done like a webinar on this topic, I was really shocked when trying to review the literature. I could only find a study investigating the experiences of autistic women going through menopause in 2020. So no one had thought until 2020 that it was important to research menopause in autistic women. So yeah, like it's kind of sad that there hasn't been much done since 2020. And it seems to be one particular researcher that's really kind of looking into it, Rachel Mosley from the UK. And this 2020 study was titled When My Autism Broke, a qualitative study spotlighting autistic voices on menopause. Oh yeah.
And so, tell me all about it. What happened when this person's autism broke?
Yeah. So basically it was a qualitative study. So investigating people's experiences. It had seven people in it, aged 49 to 63, and they're assigned female at birth. And it generated like a few different themes. So basically, one of the things that people reported was there was a lack of professional knowledge about autism and menopause, that it was hard for the autistic women to kind of get their needs met through the medical system and try to communicate what's actually going on for them, and that they didn't actually have much knowledge about menopause and how it would affect them, and that there wasn't much support. What also was reported in the study was that menopause was discussed as heightening pre-existing issues. And through the process of menopause, people found that new challenges came up for them. So new cognitive challenges, social, emotional challenges, and sensory difficulties. Basically, what Dr. Mosley brought up in the study was that because autistic women are already vulnerable in terms of mental health, and we know like some of the newer research coming out is showing that autistic women in particular are vulnerable to a lot of physical health issues, and that, you know, change can be really hard, and managing emotional regulation can be really, it can be really hard, you know, for this population, that menopause might be a challenging time for people to go through. And again, like this really wasn't looked at until quite recently. So some of the challenges that people in the study reported were they had negative experiences with health professionals, and that there was a stigma around menopause being taboo. And so that created a barrier to accessing care, that they didn't know what was normal for menopause and being autistic, and that actually getting more knowledge about both of these things led to experiencing more self-compassion while going through this transition. That it was hard when you had a late diagnosis of autism and then are going through perimenopause and menopause, and there was a lack of peer support, you know, to lean on going through this process.
Yeah, because I imagine that would make it really hard to tease apart, like, what is part of my autistic neurotype? What is perimenopause? It's like so many changes to be experiencing at once, like a huge change to your identity, and then all of these changes inside your body. So yeah, I can imagine that would be really challenging.
And I can imagine you also would want to maybe be able to talk to other older women who are going through the same thing as you.
Yes.
And a lot of the peer support programs available are for people who are late teenagers or in their early 20s. There's actually not much support for people in their 30s and then also like above, so 40 plus and 60 plus. What people also found, you know, through reporting their experiences is that common autistic experiences like finding it hard to communicate your emotions and your experiences, having alexithymia, which we've talked about on an episode of the podcast, so difficulty maybe knowing and labeling what you're feeling, and difficulty with interoception, which we've also talked about on the podcast before, were another barrier to communicating with doctors and getting their healthcare needs met. And that actually going through perimenopause and menopause led some people to go and get an autism assessment because they were kind of experiencing more challenges. So beforehand, maybe they kind of found like the right environment or the right strategies to kind of mask and cope. But what was found in this study and other studies is that going through perimenopause lifted off the mask, and people could no longer, you know, hide their struggles or their autistic traits as easily. It also impacted their sex life and their relationships. And interestingly, autistic women also reported that it did impact their executive functioning. Makes sense with what you've talked about, Michelle, of what is normal cognitively for going through perimenopause. People also reported finding it harder to regulate their emotions, and possibly, like, I wonder if maybe because of the emotional overwhelm, there was a reported increase in repetitive behaviors. So things like needing to stim and, you know, some of the people reported head banging.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes total sense because, as we know, you know, one of the purposes of stimming and repetitive behaviors is to regulate. Right? It's soothing and it's calming. And oftentimes, you know, and we can even think about this for kids or younger people, oftentimes when someone does present for diagnostic assessment of autism, it's actually when they're at a point in their life, for whatever reason, whether internal or external, that they're experiencing incredibly high stress. And so a lot of the more externally observable autistic traits are more evident, you know, like stimming, like repetitive behaviors, things like that. So that makes total sense.
Yeah, exactly. People also reported that with hot flashes, that was difficult because of their sensory issues. So particularly if you're someone that doesn't like feeling sweaty, you know, that would be really uncomfortable, or doesn't like having showers and then suddenly you're wet. Like that would be uncomfortable. There was also an increase in behaviors around self-injury and also suicidality. So having thoughts about suicide, and that would mainly come from probably an increase in distress and emotional regulation difficulties, I would say, as well as the big changes that come from this period of life. So this is where people might be separating from a partner, or their children are moving out of home, or their parents are elderly or have passed away. And, you know, it is a time where you are more vulnerable. And in the study, that was reported, you know, people reported that their chronic health conditions that they had changed, and that they were worried about their health, how to navigate this time of life. People also reported increase in meltdowns, anxiety, and depression. I think what this really calls to is that, again, during this period of time, we need to be setting up services and supports to help autistic people navigate through this time. And it's not all negative. There was a follow-up study done by Rachel Mosley in 2021. And again, I love the title. It's called Autism Research is All About the Blokes and the Kids, Autistic Women Breaking the Silence on Menopause. And so, you know, in this study, it replicated some of the previous study's findings, but they also looked at people reporting positives about going through this transition. So what the autistic women reported was that not having to deal with periods anymore was a positive, you know, because there's executive functioning demands and sensory demands and fatigue and stuff that you have to deal with when you have periods. Several people also credited menopause with increasing self-awareness. So kind of knowing what they needed and wanting to go for that. Some appreciated that due to ageism and the patriarchy, they were invisible to men. And they were like, I love this, you know, not having to deal with hair and makeup and beauty standards and all of that crap that women often have to deal with. They reported it reduced those pressures.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And this is one of the the elements of being in crone phase, right? Like, I mean, even the word crone has so much stigma around it. I love it. I think more crones. We need more crones. But yeah, absolutely. Because it's not that going into menopause or your act three immediately means that you're not a sexual being anymore. Of course you are. But I do think that for women in particular, moving into that act three, moving into that crone phase is essentially being like, oh, I am no longer a sexual object. So every sexual experience that I have, or my own sexuality, has now become completely mine. And I don't have to perform, you know, for anyone else, which I think is incredibly liberating.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the other things that people reported in the study was that they found that going through menopause actually made them make choices to look after themselves more and to do more self-care. So they would do things like, quote unquote, be more selfish, which really, to be honest, is just taking care of yourself and pursuing more self-care and activities that they actually enjoyed. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's good to kind of balance it out with the positives. And to be honest, there really hasn't been a lot of studies. There's only really been three or four. One of the last ones that I'm going to bring up, again, great title, and from 2021, and it's called Menstruation and Menopause in Autistic Adults, Periods of Importance? Question mark.
Love the pun. I love it.
So good. And it was the first study to quantitatively assess menopausal physical complaints and mental health complaints in autistic women. So they basically had 65 autistic women aged 40 years and above. And when compared to non-autistic women, the autistic women reported more menopausal complaints. And basically what it was found was like the more depressed you were, the higher the autistic traits, the more menopausal complaints were reported. But we know that, you know, sort of it's not like you're more or less autistic. It's just for the tool they used on the study.
Yeah. And I guess what's interesting about that is we could almost look at the relationship, the causal relationship in reverse there, right? Because we're seeing, okay, the higher the autistic traits, the more menopausal symptoms. But we know autistic individuals are more likely to demonstrate a higher level of externally evident autistic traits when they're extremely stressed. So just like the previous finding, you know, the more depressed you are, right? Because all of these systems, all of these mechanisms are completely interrelated and interdependent, you know, the more you're experiencing a heightened level of distress, the more your mood is impacted, the more your physical symptoms, you know, more physical symptoms you're going to experience. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is pretty much kind of what the study found. When we're looking at what are the types of complaints that people were experiencing more, they were experiencing more psychological and somatic complaints. But one of the good things is that the autistic women were not experiencing higher levels of the urogenital complaints than the non-autistic women. So kind of experiencing that side of things around the same.
So the last section for today's episode is really about what are some strategies that we can put in place? What are some things that you can do to help navigate this period of life in a way that is least disruptive to you? Again, I'm going to broken record here, keeping in mind that the challenge of menopause is really about the perimenopause period when everything is in fluctuation and everything is changing. But once we get to that menopausal point, then a lot of the things, a lot of the symptoms and challenges that, you know, we may have been experiencing during perimenopause have stabilized. And so this is really important when we think about like what are some strategies and what are some things that we can do to help. In that menopause in itself is not a hormone imbalance. It's a restructuring of our normal natural hormone ratios. So when we think about strategies, it's not about treating the menopause. It's about helping us manage the transition. So just to be really clear there. So first thing that we've talked about already today, but the first and biggest, most powerful thing that you can do to help you navigate this period is know what to expect. The more you know about what is involved in menopause, what you can expect personally, you know, if you're ADHD or autistic, you know, looking into some of the specific factors around that, but knowing what to expect so that when you experience these symptoms, you don't feel like out of control, you're not feeling shame, you don't feel like you're going through a dementing process, you're understanding that this is a normal part of the transition from your fertile years into your Act 3 stage. So knowledge is really important. The next thing that's super important is lifestyle factors. So this kind of makes sense intuitively, right? The healthier you are, the more you're taking care of your body, the better your body is going to manage this huge transition period. So something that's really important as we go through perimenopause is to be making sure we're taking care of our gut health. So as a lot of you probably know, there's huge interactive effects between our gut microbiome and our overall gut health, our mental functioning, and our overall brain functioning as well. So they're really kind of intricately linked. And so the mechanism there is that poor gut health leads to higher release of stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline, and then chronic stress, then exacerbates poor gut health and leads to inflammation. And there's a lot of issues that can come around that. So when we've got poor gut health in menopause and perimenopause, this has actually been shown to lead to a further reduction of our E2 estrogen, which, as we know, makes a lot of those physical symptoms like hot flushes and sleep, things like that, serotonin production, makes those things worse. So we really want to be optimizing our gut health and gut functioning during that period so that you're not exacerbating or further decreasing your levels of E2 as you go through that transition. So some of the things that we can do to work on our gut health or try and maintain healthy gut is ensuring that your diet has lots of fiber, probiotics, and lots of multicolored veg. And part of that is to actually aid the process of digestion and help us poop more. Okay. So if you're not pooping enough, if you experience any level of constipation, that's actually going to increase any hormonal imbalance that you have, because when we poop, we actually flush out a lot of the excess hormones that we have. So it's really important that that digestive tract is, you know, chugging along and working as it should. And the other really important thing for our gut health is to reduce our alcohol intake. Now, we know, you know, as Australians, we often have a pretty terrible relationship with alcohol. A lot of Australians drink multiple times per week at a level that's well beyond what's actually recommended. And it's really normalized in our culture. But unfortunately, in addition to a lot of, you know, the long-term brain-based effects of alcohol, which we won't get into today, but from a gut health perspective, alcohol essentially nukes your gut, right? Gets rid of a lot of the bacteria in your gut, and then it has to regenerate. But if you're drinking every day or, you know, multiple times a week, your gut isn't really getting a chance to do that. So while reducing alcohol intake is going to be helpful at any point in your life, when you're going through perimenopause, it's so important because you're going to experience an increase and exacerbation of symptoms if you're not taking care of your gut. Another really important thing that we can do during our perimenopause is make sure we're moving our body and exercising when we can.
Yeah, I think definitely with trying to exercise regularly for what's best for you and your body and your health conditions. Because some of the research that has looked at what helps people get through this transition and experience a good menopause are things like having better physical fitness and activity levels. And it is really important when you're aging and you're going through perimenopause and have achieved full menopause, especially doing some form of weight training, because we know that there are risks with perimenopause and menopause around osteoporosis and bone health. And we know that as we age, our muscle mass decreases. And, you know, some of the research also looks at having good social support. So we know for our autistic and ADHD women and people that sometimes that can be challenging. So doing what you can to link up to getting some form of social and emotional support, whether it's kind of finding an online community who are going through perimenopause and menopause, or through your interests and hobbies, through your family, your friends, and your community, that is protective. Having an optimistic mindset has also been shown to be protective in the research, and being proactive. So like what Michelle said, learning this information and being proactive in your 30s and 40s with starting to take care of your physical health and your mental health. Some other things that can be helpful are trying your best to practice good sleep hygiene. And we do have two episodes on sleep and neurodivergence in season 2 that I would recommend checking out. And in terms of helping with sleep, the Australasian Menopause Society has some good tip sheets on how to cope with the hot flashes and night sweats. So it talks about, you know, trying to help keep yourself cool using fans, air conditioning, and cool drinks. It talks about dressing in layers so that you can kind of remove a layer of clothing if you feel really hot. And it also looks at tracking your hot flashes and seeing like what has actually preceded that, because there are some well-known triggers for hot flashes. So for example, things like caffeine, alcohol, as Michelle has mentioned, stress and hot weather as well. Perimenopause would also be a time to increase your executive functioning supports and strategies, and also look at trying to build rest into your life and your routine. Also, actually having conversations about perimenopause and menopause and bringing it up and trying to break down that stigma and hearing other people's experiences can be very validating. The other well-known strategies are going to your GP and involving a specialist if you need to, like a gynecologist and your psychiatrist, and actually looking at your current treatments for your existing mental health issues, physical health issues, for your, you know, supports for your neurodivergence, and getting coordination amongst your specialists and your GP to try and manage things. And we've talked a bit about the hormone replacement therapy. So you can explore that with your medical professionals and they'll do like a full assessment and risk assessment and everything with you. And there are other medications as well that your medical professionals may prescribe to help with things like night sweats and hot flashes as well. So when I was researching for this episode, I came across New South Wales Government Health Services are actually establishing a network of menopause services across the state. So they're going to have a pathway to specialist care for people who are in that percentage that are experiencing a lot of difficulty with symptoms and have complex stuff going on for them. And they're going to set up 4 menopause hubs and have all different referral sites across the state. The menopause hubs are going to be medically led multidisciplinary services, but they will provide a holistic approach to women who are experiencing severe symptoms and the associated health risks of menopause. So like, I would love to see this rolled out across the whole of Australia. Yeah. And yeah, to kind of see this internationally as well.
It sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it really sounds like it should just be a given thing, to be honest. But yeah, like there are specialist doctors who will go through accreditation through things like the Australasian Menopause Society. And then there's a UK Menopause Society as well. So yeah, there is education and training, but I would love to see this kind of take off in the next few years.
So we really hope that you guys enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed doing it. We have a bunch of resources that we'd love to share with you guys. So we'll link them in the show notes and we'll also pop them up on our resources page on our website. So these are just books and information on menopause and perimenopause, and then resources around strategies and ways that you can best manage that transition.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom Hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman Podcast or our website ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.